Kia ora, I'm Maria.
I'm Māori and Pākehā.
And I'm Kate, and I'm Iranian-Australian.
And you're listening to Being Biracial.
It's the podcast about navigating the world as a biracial person.
We want to acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on the unceded sovereign lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri Woiwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation.
We offer our respect to the elders of these lands, past, present, and those yet to come. And we also acknowledge traditional custodians from the lands wherever this podcast is reaching you. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Today, we are going to be chatting to Lizzie Hu about being biracial.
Who's that girl? It's Lizzie!
I love that. Well done.
So if you don't already know, Lizzie Hu is one of our favourite stand-up comedians. She's also a writer, a noodle enthusiast, a designer, actor, sports lover, and rescue greyhound owner. Welcome, 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 Lizzie!
Thanks for having me. So nice to be here.
We're very happy to have you. Now, We always start our podcast with, what's your mix?
What's my mix? Well, it is so, like, on paper, I guess it's white Australian and Chinese Malaysian. But, like, mum's family, so that's Irish background / German background. And then dad is also, like, he is so mixed. Like, he's ethnically Chinese, but his grandmother's Thai. Like, he's like a mixed Malay Chinese guy. So I am like a super mix.
Like the Transformers of mixes. Yeah. When they all join together. Yeah.
And how did they meet?
Well, it's actually a pretty Hollywood meeting story. So my mum was backpacking in the – this is like 1970, 71 through Southeast Asia.
Work.
Yeah, I know. So cool. Like when I – because I know my mum now and I'm like, I can't believe you did that. Like, who are you? And so she was backpacking on her way to the UK. I think she must have been like 26, 27-ish. And then she went to Malaysia and she was hitchhiking.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? And she was hitchhiking and my dad was a salesman at the time. He worked for IAM brand, which is a famous Malaysian brand. You'll see it in the supermarkets. And so he used to drive everywhere and one of his workmates tipped him off. Was like, can you take these? Do you want to take these two Australian girls to Penang? Because that's where he was heading. And he was like, yeah. Why wouldn't I want to do that? And so, yeah, he drove my mum and her friend to Penang and then I think they had this, like, love affair. And then mum left, like, she left and then she got into a big car accident. She was hitchhiking again.
Wild. Oh, my God.
That's what she tells me. That's what you did back then. That was the only way to get around. I was like, okay. So she was hitchhiking, but she was in a truck, like a, you know, a lorry sort of thing. And her and a friend in the truck with two, they were in Thailand by this time, two Thai drivers. And at the time, there's only one-way roads. So they have the driver and then they have the lookout guy. So the lookout guy is looking for the oncoming traffic and he missed a car and they had a massive accident. Awful. Oh, like, yeah, crazy story. Like the wildest travel stories and mine are so tame compared to my mother's. So they had this accident and then she went to a hospital and she ended up – and she didn't want to tell her mum.
Classic.
So she was in like the third class Thai hospital. And she just remembers, like, waking up, there'd be bed bugs all over it. Oh. And just, like, obviously not the best healthcare. And I think she got in contact with my dad somehow and was like, I need to come back and, like, be helped. And she went and recovered at my grandmother's place.
Oh my God.
Isn't that wild?
And he was like, yeah, come on back.
Yeah.
This like love affair that I just had with this.
And then she stayed there for like another 4 or 5 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
You should write this movie.
I know. I have to wait for my parents to die.
But, yeah. Oh my God.
So my brother was born in Malaysia and mum, lived there for ages and that's how they met, which is like for a very Catholic girl from Toowoomba in Queensland. I don't know if you know Toowoomba, but it's a bit like, I guess the equivalent, it's very Bible Belt, very white, like at the time, no, like I think now it's got quite a lot of immigration, but at the time, like, no multicultural facet Toowoomba. Oh, and for her to like meet this guy who was, he's dark, like he's Chinese, but he's dark. And then, and I was like, what was that like, mum? And she just sort of, she's of that generation. That's like, it's fine. It's fine. What are you talking about? It's fine.
No problems. No problems at all. Didn't tell anyone about the accident, but came home with a child.
Yeah, came home with a child and this like really dark husband.
Oh my God. Have you talked to her about what it was like living in Malaysia for those 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I think she loved it. I think she missed home terribly, and that's why they eventually moved to Australia, because mum really missed being in Australia, and I think she missed her family as well. And dad is such a like happy-go-lucky guy that like he'd never been to Australia. Honestly, don't think he'd ever been to another country besides, well, Singapore wasn't even I don't think he'd ever been out of Malaysia. And then he comes to Australia and then just doesn't leave. So, yeah, but I think he's like one of those guys that can, like he's very easygoing, can sort of fit in to most situations. So, yeah, I think he was okay being here.
And did they move to Toowoomba?
Well, mum tried to get dad to move to Toowoomba and dad was like, I don't think so.
Not that one.
He says like every time he walked down the street, people were just like staring like, who is that? What is going on? So they moved to Brisbane.
There's like limits to the easygoing. He's like, I don't need to be perceived all the time.
Yeah,
like, let's go somewhere bigger.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you then growing up in this very multiracial family in Brisbane?
Well, I think, you know, when you're a kid, it's like, it's your normal. And I think I was born in 1983. So I think by the time I went to school, things had changed in Brisbane. I feel like it was different for my eldest brother because he's 11 years older than me. I think he has those stories of like, you know, being called Ching Chong Chinaman and all those like horrible things that you hear. Like I think he definitely had those stories and I think like we're all good at sport and on the field, like he would get racially abused on the field and stuff like that, whereas that didn't happen to me, I don't think. I don't know. But not so outwardly. So growing up for me, I felt like it was my normal. I do look back on it now. I'm like, oh, why was it in primary school that all my friends were like half something? Like we were definitely the ethnic group of a class of, I don't know, it was like 25 kids. And then in the girls, there was like two groups. And I look back on it now. I'm like, oh, one was a white group and one was the ethnic group.
The two groups were actually divided by race.
I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Like my best mates, one was half Japanese, Italian, and half Austrian, and I was half Malaysian. And it was just like, that was our thing. Like we were like quite proud of it. We were just like, yeah, you got to be something to be in this group. Yeah.
You're boring otherwise.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with that. Also the Italian and Austrian.
Yeah.
Because like at that point in time, not really like subsumed into like the group of whiteness that they might be today.
Yeah. If you had a parent with an accent, you were in.
Good to know. If we want to hang with Lizzie Who, that's what we're going to have.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I went to see the Hate Race, the play that's on at Malt House over the weekend. And it's by Maxine Beneva Clark, and we've talked about it on the podcast, her book previously on the podcast. And it's really interesting because it's basically just all these little moments that happened to her as a kid growing up in a very white suburb in the 80s. And I felt like a lot of people around me in the audience were crying. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that was because there were so many little things. And when we think about racism, so often we think about the big moments, like being vilified on a sports field, of course. But then when you look back and, you realise that you have put in these safety measures and mechanisms yourself, like with your friendship group, it's really interesting to kind of have your adult perspective looking back at your experience as a child. And I feel like that's definitely going on in that play.
And you wonder, you're like, am I just thinking this up? Am I sort of making something up in my head? Like, I do think, like, I did a lot of sport, like swimming and all that, and I was like the only Asian kid at swim squad. Tell you that, like, and I was always quite, I think I was always self-conscious of it, but never maybe knew what it was. Like, I knew I was different, but at the time it's just like, oh, why do I stand out? And then not really knowing how to deal with that. And like, mum would always say to me, like, don't let anyone tell you that you're different. Like, you're Australian. Don't, like, it was that era of like, you're the same. You're the same as everyone. Don't, you're not different. Yeah. And it's like, oh, okay. And then you get older and you go to therapy and, and they're like, so you were different.
And that's what you were feeling.
Yeah. What? Mum told me I wasn't.
I'm Australian.
Maria, did your mum ever say that? Because you also have a white mum.
Yeah, white mum's club.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I think she did kind of say to us, like, you know, you're just the same as everyone else. Yeah. You know, you can do all of the same things. Yeah. It's okay. And, like, at the same time I was like, but that doesn't seem right. I think you're wrong.
Yeah. And it's their way of, like, being nurturing and loving and them wanting you to fit in. It's like, I know it comes from a place of love, but it's like, there's been a lot of undoing.
Because in fact, I am different and it is cool.
Yeah, embrace it.
So do you think it's been a slow kind of awakening into your difference?
No, I think there's definitely, a moment where I became more proud. Like, I think as a child and as a kid, like, I don't know, it was fine. Like, I didn't struggle or anything. But I think as an adult, I was like, oh, actually, I can lean into this part of myself. I don't have to suppress it. I don't have to, like, only save it for those private family moments or anything like that. And I think, you know, it was around the time when that Facebook group, Subtle Asian Traits, came out. Mm. And my brothers and I were, like, just pinging each other these memes and things like that. We're like, we just thought that was a Chan thing. Like, we were like, oh, my God, this is, like, universal. What is going on? Like, and there were so many things. I was like, oh, my God, this is, like, cultural. And then, like, I've got a really good friend who's Vietnamese, and we started, like, we didn't talk about our being Asian at all. And then we'd be like, hey.
the look, yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's a little bit weird at the moment? Do you think things have changed? She's like, yeah. And I think, like, I think acknowledging it and starting to talk about it, I reckon I was probably late 20s when I remember seeing SBS journalist Kumi Taguchi. She's half Japanese, and she, white mum.
in the club, yeah.
She did this really great trip back to Japan, and I was like, hey, Kumi's claiming her Japanese heritage. Something I can do as well. Like, it was just like, oh, I like seeing it made it feel like possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was definitely a late thing. I've always been proud of my Malaysian Chinese background, but I feel like definitely growing up, I was probably masking it a bit or overcompensating, being like, fucking Australian, mate. Like,
yep, big time.
Yeah. So I feel like I did that a lot just to sort of slip in. And I feel like I'd still do that now, you know, if I'm in like white circles and they're talking sports, I'm like, I can talk sports, mate. Like, yes. I've got this.
But also said, who said that Asian Australians can't talk sport?
Right. And then there's that. And then it's like, and I get some comments, they're like, oh, you're like really Australian. I'm like, what does that mean? But I think that's me being the chameleon.
Yeah.
Mm. One of the things that I wanted to touch on from what you said was you shared memes with your brothers.
Mm.
And how has that been chatting with them?
Yeah, I remember us sharing this around, we're being like, oh my God, this is Chan. Like all the stuff about cutting fruit and giving, like all that sort of stuff. I was like, oh my God, this is like such a thing. And I feel like we've connected with it as we've gotten older. I've always felt this, and I don't know what it is, but I felt like I was always the most Asian. Can I say that?
Yes, you absolutely can. Now we call your brothers and we see if any of them feel.
We'll dial them in.
Yeah. I think, A, because I look the most Asian and I always remember growing up, like, I was made to cook, help in the kitchen, do all those, like, Asian girl things. And I think I was expected to be, like, a good Asian girl. And I think I grew up, like, I had more time with my dad's sisters and my aunties and things like, and I related to them. Like, it was something about hanging out with my aunties on dad's side that made me feel really at home for some reason. No offense to my white aunties.
Love you guys.
But when I'm hanging out with my Asian aunties and we're just, like, sitting around a table chatting and gossiping, I just feel like it feels very natural. So I don't know, I just felt like, yeah, that I was the most Asian.
Well, and like, what's the stereotype for like an Asian man in that context?
You know?
And is it as communal as like the woman would be?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like it is.
Well, I think my brothers now as an adult, I'm like, they are very like Southeast Asian as well. They're very charismatic, very like happy-go-lucky, no stresses, very relaxed. Like my middle brother is dad 2.0. Like they are exactly the same person. Maybe soulmates, I don't know. but I feel like we are like all Asian in some way, but maybe I embrace it more, I don't know.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's really interesting because I've just spent a month with my aunt. Mm. She, because like ethnic family things, like people don't come to Australia for a small visit.
Mm.
Like they move in with you for an entire month.
Yeah.
And so I have just had like a premium of auntie time. Mm. And so part of me is 34-year-old Iranian Australian Kate now, and part of me is 75-year-old like Persian auntie. But it's so interesting how you so quickly, because I think we're often chameleons, become like take on the traits and the attributes of the people around you. And I think there is something with my aunt, like it's all about like the making of tea and the making, preparing of food and all of that kind of thing. And now that she's gone, in my house, I'm still doing her like little rituals, and there's something so comforting like about that. Like she always puts like boiling water into the pot that she's going to put the tea in first to heat up the pot, and into the cup to heat up the cup, and then she gets rid of the boiling water, and then she puts a tea bag, the tea leaves in, then she lets it steep until they come, and you know, all of that kind of ritual. And I'm doing it in my home now, and it's so nice because it just makes me feel like, oh, yes, being Persian is as much about making my cup of tea as it is anything else, and that feels really special.
Yeah. No, it does. It does. Those little rituals definitely are things that you take on. Even, like, I think growing up I'd always sit with my knee up on my chair, and, like, I'd put my leg up on my my foot up on my leg, and my dad would always come and be like, oh my gosh, that's what my mum does, or something like that. And I'd be like, yeah, that's me.
Yeah, it just pops out.
Yeah.
What does your dad make of you doing comedy? Because I saw a video recently where you told him that you are hosting the Melbourne Comedy Festival Gala, and he seemed very excited, but perhaps didn't know quite what that meant.
And has he always been that excited?
Yeah, he's pretty excitable guy. He loves seeing, I don't know, his kids achieving, obviously, any parent does. But, yeah, he was super excited, but then having no idea what it was. It is a classic dad. And that's the thing, like, especially this world, you know, people that host the gala often say, it was my childhood dream. We used to watch the gala every year and all of this sort of stuff. And I'm like, not my childhood dream, guys. Never saw the gala until I started doing comedy. Like, this was not on in our household.
My parents don't know what it is.
Yeah, my parents. Mum is just like, oh, is that going to be on TV? I'll record it.
Yes.
I know.
That's so cute.
Because, like, even the organizer's like, are your parents going to come down? I'm like, no. Are you kidding?
They'll watch it on the tape that they recorded it on.
Yeah, this doesn't mean anything to them. So, yeah, it is, like, they love, you know, that I'm doing well. However, did have to prove that I was going to do well. Like, it took some years. I think when I did Just for Laughs at the Opera House, I think it was like 2018, 2019, something like that. And Mum and Dad came. They did come down for that because they heard Opera House. You know, they're like, oh, wow.
Fancy.
Yes.
And
I remember Mum coming out of that night after the record, and Mum was like, wow, there were really famous people on that lineup.
Not you. Yeah, not my personal child.
Not me. Wow, okay. And I think from that point they were like, she's doing this. Because up until that point it was like, oh, what do you think of Elizabeth's new hobby? Like, I really did have to prove. Even now I have to reassure them, Mum, I'm paying my superannuation. It's okay.
Oh, my God. Yes. My dad last year, because I used to be a lawyer and now I'm doing this podcast stuff and freelance, art life, whatever, yeah. He literally was like, Kate, we need to have a chat. I need you to be contributing to your super. And I had to be like, Dad, here are the receipts of me contributing to my superannuation fund. And I was like, okay, like this is it.
Yes.
This is their primary concern.
This is their stability.
Yeah.
Mm. That's what they want. Like, my parents are of that generation. They want you to go to work, have the same job for 40 years, retire with this little nest egg, and that's life. And I'm like, no, you don't have to endure life.
Let me be free.
Yeah, you can have fun. And I think Dad gets that. I think he's, like, naturally really creative, artistic guy. He, like, plays guitar and goes to more open mics than I do.
He's iconic.
I know, he really is. He really is. And I think now that he's older, like he's 85, he's like, yeah. I think he knows the meaning of life now at 85.
Yeah,
but he's
got
like, go on, yeah, do this. Have fun with life. It's too short, you know. Mm. Whereas I think if I told Mom I was going back to full-time work, she'd be so happy.
Like a day job, because it's not like you're not doing full-time work now. You're booked and busy.
I'm busy, but, yeah, I just don't think it, like, really she gets it.
How did you get into comedy? How did you go from working in a regular job into doing this?
Yeah, so I started comedy pretty late. I mean, you can start whenever you want, but for the norm, I started pretty late. I was 32 and I just come back from Mongolia, which I talked about in my last festival show, and I moved to Sydney, And I had, I think, a couple of things. I'd come back from Mongolia after this really exciting, crazy year, sensory overload. Just going to the shops was like an adventure. And then I came to Sydney and I was like, oh my gosh. Like, it was a reverse culture shock sort of situation. And I was just like, what is life? I don't know what I'm doing anymore. Everything's just available to me. And I got really like depressed and sad about what I was doing. Even though I love Sydney, I hated my job. I was really like struggling at work. And I was like, I got to do something. I got to get a creative outlet. I got to, you know, fix this. So I started doing all these courses at Sydney Community College.
Obsessed.
Oh my
educating.
God, she studied.
Yeah. She's like,
yes,
she's a nerd. I was like, which is very much my family sort of thing. Like, we're always doing something. Like, my brother's learning to sail. My dad is like always learning new songs. Mum is always doing, like, she's doing art history classes and stuff. Like we're always like, learn. We have to learn. So I was like, okay, Sydney Community College, what do you got? I did sewing classes. I did millinery course. I know, which was actually really cool. It was like, I highly recommend. And then I got an email that was said, try stand-up comedy. And I thought, yeah, like, I reckon enrollments were really low that term or something. And they're like, we need to send out the email, see if we can get more people. And I was like, yeah, that's something I've always liked comedy. I can try that, you know, tick it off the list. And I did it. It was 4 Monday nights with a class of about 30 people, all very similar reasons for doing it to me. Oh, I want to get better at public speaking, something I just want to try, oh, something to do, that sort of thing. And then at the end of the course, the instructor, he put on a friends and family show, and I did that, and I was like, oh, I really liked that. That was fun. And the teacher, and this is the power of teachers or anyone in that sort of position, all he said to me was like, oh, I think you're really good at this. You should keep going. And I was like, oh, what? Okay. Yeah, it was just like a little bit of encouragement. And then I didn't do anything for a while because I didn't know what to do next. I was like, what do I do now? And I'm like researching open mics and stuff like that. I'd never even been to a comedy club before. Like, and then I started going to different nights and just watching. And then eventually I did start doing open mics, and then I did Raw Comedy, which is the national comedy competition. And, yeah, then I just kept going. I was like really addicted. Mm.
I love the sliding doors moment where we're actually instead interviewing Lizzie Hu, world famous fashion designer. Ah!
World famous milliner.
Milliner. I know. I literally in my head I was like, what is the way that you say that? Milliner?
The house of Hu.
Oh my God.
Yes. She's making hats for like Kate Middleton.
With her sunglasses on in the car.
Yes. Yes.
Can you imagine? Yeah.
So at what point in your comedy journey did you decide to start talking about being Asian or being mixed race?
Right from the start. I think it must have been on my mind because it didn't happen. It wasn't a purpose sort of thing. I was like, oh, I can talk about this. Like, this is my thing, like not many people can. So, and I think when you first start doing comedy, you do talk about yourself. And I think I just told jokes that I said anyway, you know, like I used to have this joke in my first set, how my parents were the original Rhonda and Kutut. And like,
that's great.
But that was something I would say everywhere. They're like, you know, when people ask you like, where are you from? It's like, oh, to this. But it's like, oh, like my mum's white though. She's like Rhonda.
I love dropping the, my mum's white. And they're like,
crazy.
How could that possibly be?
So I think the first 5 to 10 minutes that I ever did was probably just a fleshed out version of what I would say in conversation anyway. But yeah, a lot of it I think was stuff I was trying to deal with at the time. It was at the time where I did start going to therapy and stuff like that. I think all those things sort of came out, and it was in kind of a way me just like dealing with that in a creative way. I think it really helped me. Yeah. Because before that, I hadn't really spoken about it. It's weird that you get up in front of strangers and speak about it, not in front of your friends or anything or to your parents or whatever. Yeah. But I think it must have been consciously something I needed to get off my chest. Mm.
We created a podcast about it. So, exactly. Yeah.
You get it.
We get it, yeah.
Safe space. But then was that funny for your, the communities around you or your parents or something like that, if it's something that you haven't really talked about with them, and then they're maybe they're seeing a clip of you and they're like, oh, this is what she really thinks.
Yeah, there's a clip that I have about my parents, about the T-shirt. I don't know if you've seen it, where it's like, you know, people ask me where I'm from, and then as a kid, I do remember asking my mum for this, a T-shirt that just said where I was from. And I distinctly remember asking mum for that, because it would happen all the time. And my mum, the punchline to that joke is mum wanted one as well, which she didn't, but mum wanted one. Mum wanted one as well that just said, I fucked a Chinese guy. And she hates that joke. She hates it because I think she thinks it's devaluing their relationship or something. I don't know, something like that. But she, probably because I'm saying fuck. But but yeah, she hates that. And I think, yeah, she's always said to me, and no more T-shirt joke, please.
She's like, everything else fair game, just not that one, please.
Yeah. Whereas dad, oh my gosh, dad lives to be mentioned.
Oh.
Like he lives for it. And I've got in my upcoming show, or the one I'm doing now, I've got a really funny story about dad. I'll tell you the crux of it. His first job in Brisbane was pumping petrol. And then he tells me they had a petrol deal and Chan would always cheat it. He was always cheating people. And then he won the competition by cheating for the petrol pumping sales or something.
Love.
And so he won best petrol pumper or something. And then he got a promotion and then he ended up getting a car parts sales job. And he said, in the interview, I was like, so why should we hire you for the job? And Jen was like, no one's going to forget me.
And that's fucking right.
Yeah. And the guy was like, that's fair.
Yeah.
So then he got this job with this car parts company and travelled up and down the east coast of Australia selling car parts to workshops and stuff. And then he was like, hang on a minute, I could start my own thing here. And that's when he opened his muffler shop. Yeah, and so when he owned the muffler shop, he had a Lebanese taxi driver come into the shop and ask him where he's from. He's Malaysia, which is predominantly Muslim country. But dad's not, he's Chinese, he's Buddhist. And then the taxi driver's like, oh, are you Muslim? And dad was like, yes. Oh.
No.
He's like, yes. He saw the dollar signs. He was like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. My name's Hassan.
That, talk about chameleon.
So, yeah, there was a time in dad's life where he was Hassan from Malaysia, just to get in your business.
Hassan was hustling.
He was hustling. So, yeah. But I'm like, dad, and I'm doing that, this joke. I tell him, I'm like, dad, Hassan, he's killing it in the show. It's actually one of the best parts of the show. And dad's like, oh, great. He's so excited.
He's like, tell the people my stories.
Yeah, he's so excited for Hassan to make his debut.
Have you thought about getting a T-shirt for your mum that says, I fucked Hassan?
She could have two. Because the story is that, this ruse, he had it going for years. So mum and him were out one night in Brisbane and they were trying to get a cab home, and one of his dad's customers saw mum and dad on the side of the road and pull over. It was like, Hassan, get in, I'll take you home. And mum was like, what? 10.
Wow.
Yeah.
And nobody forgot about him.
Nobody forgot about him.
I'm obsessed that he loves that he is part of your show.
Oh, and like, yeah. And he'll do stuff at home. Like if I'm up there, he's like, what about this? And I'm like, no, don't force it. Like just act how you usually act and then I'll be like, okay, that's hilarious.
Go about your business.
Oh my God. My mum said exactly the same thing to me the other day. We were just hanging out, me, her and my aunt, and then she was like, well, that could go in the podcast. And I was like, that's not how this works. You just, I'm not your personal broadcasting service. Hi, Mum. Thanks for listening.
Love you so much, Faraday.
Do they listen?
Yeah, they do. It's really nice. But yeah, exactly the same kind of situation where, now she's trying to feed me stories and I'm like, that's it's not a matter for you, Mum.
Yeah, it's true.
So you've obviously been really comfortable with talking about being mixed race in your comedy for years now, but I'm wondering how it is for you to be in a scene that is more and more diverse but has very, very white roots. Like, what is that like for you?
Yeah, it's definitely – it's so diverse at the moment, like compared to when I started. And I think I started at a really opportune time. Like it was the time where they were crying out for more diverse voices. They needed more women than anything else. Mm. Like they were crying out for more women. And now I see like there's so many different types of comedian out there. Like you can see whoever you want to see, which is great. I feel like definitely behind the scenes, the gatekeepers definitely still a white world. But I feel like there's been a lot of like learning that's gone on. And I had a similar question the other day where like I feel like on screen, like facing, it's changing, but behind the scenes, still very male, still very white. And that sort of, that must influence things. But I feel like people, and I have a business degree, and I feel like they have realized, hold on a minute, we're missing like out on all of these markets because we don't have the right talent. And I think that's changing things in some way. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot lately, the idea of visible diversity, because it's definitely something that I have noticed is that people are really conscious about making sure that, voices and people on screens and people on stages and all of that kind of thing are more diverse. But, when you peel back one layer, often everyone behind the scenes is white.
Yeah.
And I find it so deeply ironic when they're like, we are here, we are creating culturally safe, diverse spaces. And you're like, okay, so I am the talent and I am in a room of all white people. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, thank you for saying that it's a culturally safe space, but you have spelt my name wrong 4 times in 4 different ways and I've told you every time. So I'm not feeling super culturally safe, am I?
Yeah, it is. It is an interesting one. I think I'm at an advantage being mixed race and being in the white world. I know how to speak white.
Yeah.
Like I know what to do, but I do feel like I'm like, oh, I've been in this situation before, I know what to do. But I do think like for other people, what does that feel like for them? I don't know. Like it is a really, I think it's changing and I think it will take time. Yeah.
Yeah, because you can't, you can't go from being a comedian to being somebody who's like funding all of these things. Like that doesn't seem like a smooth transition to do overnight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like at least, we get to go and sit in audiences where and watch comedians that like every night of the week, someone who is a POC, which I feel like even a few years ago was not the case.
Yeah.
Like, I think I remember looking at a program a while back and I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'd love to see some, like, people of color who are comedians, maybe women. That would be great. And there was, like, more Chappelle Corby-related shows than like...
Yeah.
POCs, and I was like, how is this the world that we are working in?
What's happening here?
It's changed, and there's definitely places where you can go and see, like, well, just regular lineups. There'll be a POC on the lineup or two. Or sometimes I turn up and I'm like, whoa, is this Asian comedy night? What's going on? Like, it'll be like three of us. Like, has there been a booking error? What's happening? Because there's, like, in the comedy community, there's so many more Asians now, and it's great. So good. But we don't need any more, just saying.
You're like, sorry, I've got this corner of the market.
Yeah.
Is it one of those things where you do find yourself, like, competing for roles on lineups or things like that, where they will be like, all right, we've got one where we've ticked our box.
Probably. I don't know. Like, I'm sure that happens. Like, oh, we don't need another one. But definitely for acting roles, like, I know if I'm being put forward for something, I'll message the other Asian female comedians and be like, hey, you're doing this role? You want to do it together? Like, you want to shoot this together? And they're like, yeah, I'm doing it.
You've got like a little network.
Yeah. And then none of us get it. We're like,
We don't even know them. They're not in the WhatsApp group.
New to the scene.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
And then on the flip side, I guess, what about it's something we've talked about a lot, but like, what about if you don't want to, if you just want to tell a silly joke, are you like, oh, I've really got to tell that identity joke, like that's what people expect from me? Or no, you're like, I'm fine telling a completely different.
Well, it is something I think, sometimes I think it's an easier joke to tell. Sometimes the, you know, like something about your ethnicity or something like that. Potentially. This show that I'm doing now is, it's not like I tell stories about my dad and like I have to give context of mum and dad and like, you know, mum's white, just remember that, like, you know, just for the picture. But overall it's not, it's not like last year was like quite heavy on the race, heavy on the identity stuff, whereas this year I'm like, you know what, I'm not going to talk about it this year. And sometimes it's a challenge to myself like as well, let's just write jokes about whatever. But I don't think it's on my mind as much, maybe, whereas last year it did feel like that.
I think we're going through a similar thing.
Yeah, yeah, big time. I feel like we spent a lot of time last year or the year before talking about being biracial really literally, and now we're like, okay, we've kind of tread that ground and we have learned a lot about ourselves and, you know, the community and how it is to do that. But, like, let's zoom out a little bit and talk a bit more about, you know, things like we've talked about with you, like your artistic practice and, you know, how we bring it to our artistic practice without making it all the whole thing.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of a bit zeitgeisty at the moment as well. Like, I think we've had this, you know, period of learning about ourselves and now it's like, okay, we've accepted and we're just, like, doing the thing.
And a bit of, like you said, like cathartic processing, like through whatever artistic practice you use, you go through that. And there was a particular moment, especially a few years ago, where you were like, oh my God, everyone's listening. Everyone wants to finally hear the story. I'm so excited to tell the story. Please listen to me.
Yeah.
And then now we're like, oh, I'm silly and joyful and I like talking about other things too.
Yes.
So one last thing I want to talk to you about is that all of your comedy shows have your name in them. Who cares? I just watched it on Amazon Prime. Oh. You guys should watch it too. It's amazing. But tell us about your name and tell us about how you bring it into all of your comedy shows.
Yeah, it's a funny one because growing up, like everyone made fun of my name. Like, that's what I remember as a kid. And I even remember as a kid being like, I can't wait till I can get married so I can change my name.
Lizzie, I would marry you for your name. Yeah. For you, but yeah. For your name.
But now I'm like, I don't want to get married. And I just wouldn't, even if I did, I wouldn't change my name because it's like part of my culture. It's part of my identity. And it's so weird. And I think growing up, I was like, I never want to make a joke out of my name. And now I do it.
Every show.
Yes.
I'm taking ownership of it, guys.
Reclaiming.
Reclaiming my name. No, it's just so easy. Because when you have to submit a show, it's mostly practical. Because when you submit a show, you have not written the show. So it's like, 1 year I did, I was like, I'm not doing the who pun thing anymore. And then someone said to me, why not? This is a brand.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, yeah, what am I doing? I'm an idiot.
I have a business degree. Yes. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. And I think you do have really, really strong branding. Like even with the artwork that you have, the name pun, it's like, it's on.
Yeah. So, and I think now there's also like, I try and make a bit of a hype about like, who, like, what's the name going to be? Who's going to choose it and all that sort of stuff. I just think it's a bit of fun. And honestly, I'm blessed with a very comedic last name. Why not use it?
You absolutely have to.
Yeah.
You absolutely must. I saw that you did like a little Instagram thing about like guess the name and I was like, is she crowdsourcing future names? Like, is that what's going on here, Lizzie?
Well, most of them are terrible. I will say that. The name, I'm like, guys, come on. And then only two people guessed this one out of like hundreds of people that responded. Two people guessed it.
Well, tell the people the name of your upcoming comedy show so that they can go along.
Yes, it's called Who's That Girl? I'm playing Melbourne the whole month for Melbourne Comedy Festival in Sydney, Canberra, Brisbane and Newcastle.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
So where should people go to get tickets to all of these things?
Yep, you can go to my Instagram at Lizzie Who or my website, Lizzie Who. What is it? Lizzie Who. LizzieWho.com.
Nailed it.
That's my name, right, Lizzie?
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Lizzie. It has been an absolute joy to talk to you. We appreciate you, and we can't wait to see your show. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to episode 2 of season 2 of Being Biracial.
This podcast is hosted, edited, and produced by us, Kate Robinson and Maria Birch Moranga.
The wonderful music that you are listening to right now is by the Green Twins, and this is their amazing song, Take It Slow.
Special thank you to Footscray Community Arts for letting us use their podcast studio here on the lands of the Kulin Nation.
Talk to you all soon. Bye.
Bye.